Good afternoon and welcome to the Senior Statesman of Virginia's June program. I'm Jeff Gould, President, and we're delighted to have you in our audience today. Our Senior Statesman of Virginia organization is now 25 years old, and we are pleased and very proud that we have presented so many programs of excellent interest and import for people in Central Virginia. We are going to continue that today with a really excellent program on broadband here in the Commonwealth. But first, I wanted to alert you to a couple of things, a little business, and that is that, as is our custom at Senior Statesman, we do not have a meeting in July. So we will be silent for that month. However, the good news is that our August program will be returning to in-person meeting. We will be back at the center for our August meeting, and we will also do that in a hybrid model so that those folks who are still choosing to stay at home and can watch it on Zoom. And without further ado, it's my real pleasure today to introduce one of our directors here at Senior Statesman, Norman Dill, and he will be our host and the moderator for today's program. Norman, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. Welcome, everybody. I'm really glad to hear that we're going to be doing the live meetings again in August. That should be great. So today we have a program on the internet and in Virginia. Evan Feinman, Executive Director of the Tobacco Region Revitalization Commission and Chief Broadband Advisor to the Office of Governor Ralph Northam. So Evan has been working in the government for several years and is taking on this job to expand, I assume, broadband access to people in the Commonwealth. Are we ready to go ahead? Evan, you all set?
Absolutely, Norman. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
I'm thrilled to do it. I think it's I'm looking forward to sharing what the Commonwealth is doing and has done and will do, and then also hopefully do some Q&A, because I think that's often both entertaining and illuminating. So, you know, the governor set the goal of universal broadband coverage in July of 2018. And at the time, he set that as a goal for no later than 2028, a 10-year goal. That was seen as a stretch, but an achievable stretch to get us to universal coverage. The reason that we wanted to set it as a 10-year goal, in addition to sort of the classic political callback to a moonshot, is that we believed, and we were correct at the time, that we were going to need to do an awful lot of persuasion. Most Virginians at that time still had access to a broadband connection, just as we are able to get on this Zoom, or yeah, it's a Zoom. I always want to try to correctly name whichever software we're using. Just as we all are able to access the Zoom call today, most Virginians at that time were able to get online. And so building a broad political consensus for supporting a small minority of Virginians, especially when that consensus was going to require the expenditure of significant resources, was a big undertaking. But it was something that Governor Northam really felt very deeply was worth making one of his top priorities. And he was very clear from the moment he entered office, this was one of his top three priorities. If you think about why that should be, it really falls into three big buckets. The first is economic. Flat out, a community without access, broad and we would say ubiquitous access to broadband, will not grow. Wearing my other hat, so you know, you heard I both run the Tobacco Commission and the Broadband Advisor. Through the Tobacco Commission, which brief background, economic development organization focused on Southern and Southwest Virginia, funded out of the tobacco companies. We don't support or advocate cigarettes. When I talk to a corporate leader, if they're looking to locate a facility in a community that doesn't have access to broadband, and they learn that that community doesn't have access to broadband, we're talking about a different community. There simply is not an opportunity to significantly grow a local economy without access to broadband. On the flip side, the ROI involved in expanding broadband is really dramatic. Amazon and the United States Chamber of Commerce did a study a couple years ago that focused on a state-by-state analysis. And just in Virginia, they anticipated more than $2.25 billion in increased annual sales, more than $1.25 billion in new value added, more than 9,000 jobs, and almost $500 million in new annual wages as a result of getting to ubiquitous broadband. And then if you think about our largest industry, which is agriculture, and when I say our largest industry, I think people are often surprised by that, but it isn't just our largest industry, it's our largest industry by a mile. Agriculture and forestry as a sector reflect in a normal year, and this has been anything but in a normal year, in the 90s of billions of dollars per year in Virginia. The next closest two sectors tend to be tech and tourism. They tend to be in the 20s of billions of dollars in economic activity per year. So when we think about our largest industry, it's significantly larger. USDA's Economic Research Service, which is a very high caliber set of government economists, in a 2019 study found that if you were to expand broadband universally and then encourage adoption of precision agriculture tools, things like soil monitors, smart fertilizer and water use, health monitors for animal agriculture, you could see an increase of 18% in agricultural production. Just here in Virginia, that'd be $16.3 billion per year in new annual ag and forestry economic activity. So the upside of getting this done is tremendous. Beyond, though, the economic impacts, there's also really strong social and political demands being made by the citizens who don't have access to broadband. When Governor Northam came into office, we estimated that there were right around 660,000 Virginians at somewhere between 450 and 500,000 different locations that did not have access to broadband infrastructure. For those families and for those businesses, this was their top political and social demand. And if we, as servants of the public, are going to do our jobs well, we're obliged to be responsive to something that hundreds of thousands of Virginians indicate as their top public policy priority. The third, though, area that we came to in the governor's office was that the economic argument is strong. The fact that we ought to be responsive to our constituencies is a strong argument to control our actions as well. But what really drove this to the top of the list of something that we wanted to work on was that it became increasingly clear as we looked at the issue that this was something that we had a moral and ethical responsibility to solve. Flat out, as a statement of our values, it's unacceptable for hundreds of thousands of Virginians not to enjoy a service and a standard of living that the rest of Virginians consider essential. Worse, it's our most vulnerable populations in the areas that aren't served by broadband that suffer the most. Children and their education, especially post-COVID. We know that kids who grow up in a household that doesn't have access to reliable broadband connection, even when you do good scholarship, right? You control for the affluence of the family, control for the education level of their parents, their post-secondary outcomes are worse. They're less likely to seek additional education. They're less likely to seek credentials, and their earnings are diminished. Additionally, elderly folks, there are a lot of really remarkable advances that have been made to make it possible for elderly folks to safely age in place if they have a broadband connection. If they don't, unfortunately, their ability to stay in their home, which they would prefer, and their ability to avoid assisted living or nursing home situations, which they, their finances, and for those folks who are on public health care plans that the taxpayers would prefer, their ability to do that is dramatically reduced without access to broadband at the home. And then finally, we know that rural areas are the areas that are most in need of infrastructure. We know that our military and veteran populations are overrepresented as a percentage of the population in rural areas. And we know that the veterans population has a deep need for both telehealth and telepsychiatry. I don't want to belabor it, but you know, the particularly the veterans mental health crisis is very, very real. We will lose a handful of veterans to suicide as we talk this afternoon. And so all of that combined to make it very clear for Governor Northam, and then that, of course, translates through the whole executive branch, that getting as many Virginians online as quickly as possible was an absolute necessity. If there is a single silver lining to the COVID crisis, it is that to some extent, the pandemic did a bit of our persuasion work for us. Most people now understand the necessity of easy, reliable, affordable broadband access for everyone at this point. So again, the governor set a really bold goal. He said, we're going to get the universal broadband coverage no later than 2028. And as the governor is fond of telling me, and I'll report it to y'all, that no later than was an operative part of that directive. So if our team hooks up the last household in December of 2028, that's a D minus. At that same time, he created the Office of Broadband Advisor and tasked our office with scoping the problem, developing a plan to solve it, and then implementing that plan. That plan really has three big parts. The first is making policy changes to make it easier, cheaper, and more effective and efficient to deploy broadband. We can do some of those policy changes within the four corners of the executive branch, others in partnership with the legislature. We'll talk about that in a bit. The second is local planning support. One of the key aspects of our program is that we've given local governments and groups of local governments a seat at the table, where previously they'd really been sidelined and it had been entirely a private sector endeavor with some input from the federal government about how we were going to expand these networks out to folks who needed them. And then the third is direct grants to public-private partnerships to make the math work. And the reason I say make the math work is that a unit of broadband infrastructure, whether it's fiber on poles or transmission equipment adequate to serve a certain area, costs pretty close to the same amount, whether you're talking about Arlington or Allegheny. The difference is the amount of revenue that you can gain through your investment of that capital to build that infrastructure is dramatically different, right? Because the revenue is really reflected in the number of new paying customers you can get per investment in unit of infrastructure. Once you get below a certain population density, you lose every for-profit entity because they could make more money parking their dollars in the S&P than they could expending their capital to build broadband infrastructure out to places where they'll get a lower return. Once you get to an even lower density than that, even mission-driven actors like nonprofits and electric cooperatives are not in the business of losing money. Not as they're quick to emphasize, not for profit doesn't mean for loss. And so you have to add public subsidy so that you can make it viable to build out these networks and operate them and maintain them in an efficient fashion without ongoing public subsidy. So one of the things we're very proud of is the way in which our grant program works. And we'll talk about that in a sec. On top of all of that, we knew that this needed to have a really broad push. And so we created the Commonwealth Connect Coalition. And I want to give a particular shout out to a member of my team, Kyle Rosner, who's the Deputy Broadband Advisor, who came to us from the healthcare sector and has really dived into our work here in a big way and contributes all over the place. But one of the things that he's been key on has been creating this Commonwealth Connect Coalition. I've been in and about state politics, you know, up and down the East Coast and in Virginia for a while, and I've never seen a coalition like this. There are over 125 different organizations, from the state chamber to the Virginia Education Association to the Sheriff's Association, the Municipal League, the Association of Counties, Microsoft, Walmart, Amazon, the Realtors, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Sheriff's Association. And I apologize to the 100 and some odd that I failed to mention there, but you get the idea. It's this incredibly broad group of organizations reflecting all of these different aspects of our society and our lives and our economy that have all come together around a shared vision that says we have to get the universal broadband coverage in Virginia, and we have to support fully funding of that effort by the General Assembly. And leveraging that coalition has been really remarkable. So turning to the three buckets I discussed, we'll start with some of the policy changes that we needed to make this happen. The biggest one is actually, and I was literally just at a bill signing ceremony making permanent a program that we piloted a while ago that we're particularly proud of. It's now been copied in a number of other states. Our electric utilities, our main investor-owned electric utilities, Dominion and Appalachian Power, are already building telecommunications networks within their electrical grids for the purposes of creating a smart grid. They need to be able to monitor their devices outside without sending a crew and a truck. They also need to be able to adjust their grid devices so that they can accept intermittent generation from renewable sources, which are an increasingly important part of the electrical generation portfolio. we as electric ratepayers are going to pay to string that fiber within those electrical grids. But because of their regulatory structure, they were not allowed to do anything other than build the minimally necessary telecommunications network inside the grid that they needed to run a smart grid. We were, with some doing and with the partnership of the telecommunications industry, we were able to get a change, a really landmark change in the way the State Corporation Commission regulates our investor-owned utilities to give them the ability, and it's a little more technically complex than this, but effectively to give them the ability to pull a thicker cable instead of a thinner cable and lease that excess capacity out to internet service providers to serve unserved areas. That did two really remarkable things for us. The first is it made it a lot cheaper to serve those unserved areas, because now, rather than having to build network all the way from wherever X, Y, or Z internet service provider has access to the broader internet, they can build it right off of wherever the nearest Dominion or APCO access point is, and then they can build their network where they need it, and then they can ride the utilities fiber back out to the internet. The second thing it did is it blew the doors off globally the number of different folks who could compete for each of these areas. Previously, you really kind of had to work with the folks who had network nearby. Nobody was going to, you know, build 100 miles of fiber just so they could serve a 5-square-mile area over here. Now, anybody in the whole world can drop a network in, fill gaps between existing network, and again, ride the utilities fiber out to the broader internet. We've also done a lot with our partners in VDOT to make it easier, cheaper, faster, smarter to attach to bridges, cross overpasses, use public land. We made some changes to the way that prescriptive easements are treated. And we've also changed some of the way that localities are able to negotiate with new solar developments, effectively recreating the old proffer system. Those utility scale solar developments need broadband themselves. They're generally happy to support projects that don't just connect their facility, but also help connect the rest of the region. And, you know, those have been hugely impactful. It's very challenging to take this on without working with the folks who own the poles. Additionally, you know, I just want to give a credit to the electric cooperatives who have didn't need that legislative change and have been huge partners for us throughout this entire effort. So that's kind of policy bucket. Second area where we did a lot of work was on local planning support. The local governments generally don't have a person on staff who is a knowledgeable network engineer. That's perfectly sensible. There's no reason they would. But as a result, it's been very challenging for local governments to be able to take control over what in most other contexts would be considered, you know, mission critical infrastructure. Your local government, your county or city, by and large, controls your natural gas distribution. It by and large controls your water and sewer. It by and large controls your roads. Their ability to get involved in how these projects are developed has been a big part of our success. And one of the reasons that they've been able to do that is because we now have a large, highly capable team within the Department of Housing and Community Development that is able and willing to support at no cost local government partners as they try to develop projects. We were also able at our website, commonwealthconnect.virginia.gov. That's commonwealthconnect, all one word, .virginia.gov. I've never really been able to figure out why every state web address needs to be so long, but that seems to be the way we do things up here. In any event, at our website, we've generated a broad toolkit in support of local leaders. That contains a step-by-step guide, model solicitations and MOUs, examples of successful projects, FAQs, pitfalls, facts and figures to support you as you need to convince other local leaders, really everything you need in a comprehensive basis to arm you to support build out of broadband networks in your locality or region. But the final area that we've really, and this is where the rubber hits the road, or ideally where the, you know, the fiber hits the pole, is in our grant funding program. And as we said, we've got to make that math work. And so we've designed what we call the Virginia Telecommunication Initiative. This program is one that we're very proud of. Between it and a handful of other state grant programs, we've already supported projects that have led to the connection of over 140,000 homes and businesses, 108,000 of which were connected before the pandemic started. And I just want to once again emphasize how fortunate we are that this was something that Governor Northam made a priority early in his tenure, because that's 108,000 families and businesses that were able to carry on some version of normal life during the pandemic. This program works by making awards to partnerships between local governments or units of local governments and ISPs or groups of ISPs. These projects are then evaluated primarily along the question of, is this the most cost efficient approach to getting everybody high quality, affordable broadband connectivity? We're really proud of our success there. That program runs at right about 3.5 times more cost efficient than comparable Federal Communications Commission programs. And our build times, where the FCC gives you between 6 and 8 years, we give you between 1 and 2. So we build it, we build three and a half times as much, right around, 6 to 3 times as quickly. And that's part of our great success. There's still a heck of a lot to do, but we're very proud of what we've gotten done. Additionally, we're about to see a real tidal wave of federal support hit this issue, hit this problem. The American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, which was passed in January, allocated literal billions of dollars to the Commonwealth of Virginia at the state level and across disbursements to various localities. We are in the process of working with the United States Treasury to develop guidelines that can control the way that works. But at a minimum, we're going to be deploying 50 million state dollars and 220 million federal dollars, with some additional significant percentage of the more than 4.1 billion fiscal recovery funds that came to this Commonwealth centrally and the 3 billion that came to localities, so that we can get this job done. This is something that we can and will do. We know how to build infrastructure. The only thing holding us back at this point is maintaining political will and the literal construction capacity of the internet service provider sector, which is increasingly going to be a bottleneck and something that we're going to need to address. The second side of the digital divide is something that we should also talk about, though, and that's the affordability question. Building new infrastructure out to folks is something that we really have a good grasp on. Dealing with the affordability issue is absolutely the tougher policy challenge. There are as many as 1.5 million Virginians who are classified as low or moderate income. There's right around 360,000 Virginia households that are SNAP eligible. SNAP is supplemental nutritional assistance. It's food stamps. Those are folks who probably don't have $50 to $130 a month to spend on broadband. So we're going to need to figure out how we can get them online. And we've got a couple of really good models to get that done. We pulled in researchers from the Pew Charitable Trust, the National Governors Association, the Benton Institute, and a number of other partners to develop some unique models. And we were able to pilot a bunch of those using the CARES Act last year. And we're optimistic that we're going to be able, as soon as we get more guidance from the Treasury, to use ARPA funds to scale up those pilots. Essentially, what we're thinking that we're going to be able to do is support the construction of new infrastructure in already served areas that'll be publicly owned, that'll go straight to the folks who can't otherwise afford service. One of my favorite examples of this was a CARES Act project that we funded in Portsmouth, Virginia. More than 1,000 public housing units have fiber connectivity now at no cost to the resident of that public housing unit owned by the city of Portsmouth. If we had just paid those folks bills, even at a very low cost program, 3 years from now, we would have already spent more than it cost us to build that fiber out one time. And in year four on the subsidy model, we'd still have nothing. We'd have to keep digging that hole in the sand. But by building those sorts of very targeted, very purpose-built infrastructure in already served areas, we can assist low-income Virginians so that they can get online as well. In areas where we've already had to subsidize service, subsidize network construction, we're certainly not going to build a second whole network. We are going to need to do some kind of ongoing subsidy for low-income folks in less dense areas. Fortunately, as a result of the Recovery Act, for the next 5 months, there is a federal subsidy of right around $50 a month. That is usually, though not always, adequate to get folks online. We are going to we're pushing strongly for the feds to make that permanent for very low income households. Without that, it will be a real challenge for poor folks in less dense areas to be able to get online. But we got to do it, because all of the reasons that we laid out at the beginning, we believe that we have an economic responsibility, a political obligation, and a moral imperative to get this done. We're working through our Department of Social Services right now, doing a pilot program, and we think we're going to be able to make some real progress on that subsidization question out in remote areas, but that's going to take a little doing. And that's why we're still considering that a pilot. I'm very happy to get into the weeds on that with you if you would like. Otherwise, I think we're going to have to, we can talk about that in the Q&A, but I don't want to dive too deeply into what now is a speculative pilot. I will also say that we're very optimistic that this is a project that we're going to be able to get done during the next governor's administration. This governor is going to make some announcements here in the next couple of weeks about the progress that's been made during his administration. I don't want to spill the beans or steal the boss's thunder. That's never a good idea. But you should note that it took us about a year to really get this thing off the ground. And we believe the next governor is going to be able to solve it. So you can intuit about the amount of progress we believe we've made. All told, we're going to solve this problem for Virginia. We're doing it effectively and efficiently. And it's very exciting because it's really going to yield dramatic benefits for hundreds of thousands of folks in our cities, in our towns, in our rural areas. And it's incredibly rewarding to be able to be entrusted by the governor with such an important project and to, you know, get up every day and work with a team of incredibly talented folks in the governor's office, in the Department of Housing and Community Development, at the Library of Virginia, at VDOT, really across state government. This has been an all hands on deck effort. And all of our success really is owed to the work of those folks and our partners in local government and the industry. We're going to get the remaining 233,500 homes and businesses connected in the next couple of years. And Virginia is very likely to be the first large state in the union to get this done. I don't give Delaware a ton of credit. I'm happy to talk about any questions that y'all have. Otherwise, it's just been a pleasure to join you this afternoon. And thank you very much. I look forward to the rest of the program.
Hey, thank you very much, Evan. Okay. Thank you, Evan. This is really informative and huge amount of progress just in the last few years. So this is a time, let me talk to the audience here, that we do have time for some questions. So if you want to ask a question, go to the Q&A, probably at the bottom middle of your screen says Q&A, and type those in, and we'll try to get to them. Let's see, let me go to the first question. And I don't have names here, but Robert McGrath asks, thanks for this talk. Very exciting. Two questions. One, what's the minimum download and upload speed you consider to be broadband connectivity? And I'll just read the second part of the question is, what about folks who have DSL connectivity and are far off main roads? Any hope for them to have better service?
Sure. So two really good questions, two deep questions. First, we consider you unserved by broadband if you do not have access to infrastructure able to get you a 25 megabit per second download and 3 megabit per second upload. Those are the folks that we consider unserved. I will say that by and large, the networks that we build are much faster than that. And so the first question is kind of eligibility for state subsidy. The second is what we construct. We almost exclusively construct symmetrical networks, which is to say the upload and the download speed is the same. It's not always true in all wireless situations, but by and large, it's true. Second, the question about folks who have DSL connectivity and are off main roads. And it's kind of two questions. Most of the time, DSL is not going to get you to 25.3. A little inside baseball at the federal level. The reason the FCC moved specifically to 25.3 was at the behest of the non-DSL providers, because by and large, DSL just can't meet that benchmark. So most folks who are on DSL are eligible to have new network built to them with some state subsidy. For folks who are far off of main roads, this is a real challenge. This is what the industry calls long drops. And the challenge is that often somebody will be quoted $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. There's network at the street, at the top of their driveway or private road, but they don't have it down at their house, which is obviously where you'd rather be online as opposed to standing out in the middle of the street. we are optimistic that we're going to be able to carve out some of these federal dollars to support those long drops for folks who are economically disadvantaged. We're going to run that in a need-based fashion. We did that during the when we had $30 million CARES Act dollars that we were able to distribute. We want to make sure that's need-based, though, because some people who have very long driveways are quite wealthy and can swing it just fine. And there's certainly no reason to spend a lot of additional public resources to help wealthy folks who would just rather not pay for it. I do believe that we are going to get that done one way or the other. It's also worth noting that in areas where new network is constructed, those long drops can be rolled into a state subsidization ask, and we'll pay for them up front.
I just want to thank you for your consideration to have a Charlottesville poster that you must have put that up for this presentation in your office there.
I love maps, and I went to UVA, so it's
oh, okay.
I've actually got a map of Rockbridge County and Lexington. You can't see it, but I also went to WNL for law school.
Okay. On a more serious note, are you comfortable that Terry McAuliffe will continue the commitment of Ralph Northam to expand the broadband for the whole Commonwealth?
Well, it would appear somebody told my dad that I'm on. So, hi, Dad. I'm very comfortable that both Terry McAuliffe or Glenn Youngkin will get this job done. I think Terry McAuliffe has laid out more specifically and boldly that he's going to get the job done. But frankly, at this point, unless a governor was flat out opposed to it, I think we've got a strong enough bipartisan consensus within the Virginia General Assembly that the legislature, which in most policymaking and appropriations contexts is the most powerful branch, wants to see this done. And so, you know, I think it'll happen either way. I personally am a Terry McAuliffe supporter, and I believe he'd do an excellent job at this. But, you know, I think Virginians can count on either major party nominee to get the job done. I can't necessarily speak for the far less likely to prevail third party folks.
Okay, thank you. Any comments on how Elon Musk's satellite program may affect the state's broadband connectivity or connections?
Yeah, so this is a topic that we talk about a lot. There is no technological silver bullet that's going to gallop in and save, mixing my metaphors there, but it doesn't matter. This is not going to get us across the finish line on its own, and nobody's going to take this problem out of our laps. Starlink is, which is the name for Elon Musk's satellite program. There's a couple of, they're ahead because he happens to also own a rocket ship company. There are a couple of other low Earth orbit satellite programs that are going to be going into effect soon. Really briefly, traditional satellite broadband relies on geostationary satellites that hover, that orbit the same spot on Earth all the time. That's easier because your antennas know where the satellite is, and the satellite can get back to everybody it's supposed to get to. The challenge is that geostationary orbits are high above the Earth. And while we can change a lot of laws here in Richmond, we can't change any physical laws. And the laws of physics say that a radio signal takes a certain amount of time to get from your satellite dish up to the satellite, down from the satellite to a receiving station, out to the internet, back to the receiving station, up to the satellite, back down to your computer. So that's why traditional satellite services have a lot of what we call lag or latency. The low Earth orbit satellites aim to solve that problem by doing what it sounds like, orbiting far closer to the surface. The challenges that they have there, though, are myriad. First, those are not geostationary orbits. So those satellites are streaking across the sky at very high speed. So maintaining connectivity to the ground presents a significant technological challenge. One they have largely overcome, but it limits their total throughput. They have some other technological problems. They have some pricing problems. They're still in a beta test, so we don't know what their long-term economic model is going to look like. It's worth noting that when they're fully built out to about 36,000 satellites, something like 12,000 of those satellites will fall into the atmosphere and burn up every year forever. And so we do believe that, you know, they're burning through startup capital right now, but we don't know what they're going to need to charge to keep hucking 12,000 satellites into the air every single year. That said, you know, there is a strong use case for these satellite connections, and it's the very remote folks. While I don't think that they're going to be able to replace proven, mature terrestrial technologies like fiber to the home and fixed wireless, in large part because there's a, as I said, they have a throughput issue. I don't think more than a few hundred thousand East Coast folks can be served by their fully built out constellation. You know, that would barely cover everybody in Virginia, let alone North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, et cetera. Folks who are quite remote, people who are in, say, you know, Northwest Highland County or the far coal fields, where it would cost hundreds of thousands or potentially millions of dollars to get a fiber or even a radio signal to that specific location. Those are the folks for whom this is a great service, and it should be a tool that we use in our toolbox, but it's part of a broader portfolio of options. And I really want to emphasize that the two technologies that are really mature are fiber to the home and fixed wireless. That's what we're building. Those are future-proof is a term that makes fools of us all eventually, but you know, those are assets that we're going to be grateful to have for, you know, at least the next few decades.
Okay. Thank you. Next question is, are there additional strategies that can be used to foster more price competition among internet providers?
Sure. The best way to do that would be increased competition. The challenge with that is, one, I don't want to spend a heck of a lot of public dollars getting people multiple service provider options when there are still hundreds of thousands of people who have none. When it comes to being equitable and solving this problem in a fair way, we want to make sure that we do that focusing on the most acute and critical problems first, and then moving on to sort of the nice to have questions. Second, there are some real issues related to publicly subsidized and financed overbuilding of networks that were created by private investment. We still need these things to float their own boats. We certainly don't want to create a situation in which the market has been sliced up so thinly that everybody's losing money and things are not working well. I do think there is a space in dense areas, and by which I mean an economic space in dense areas, for publicly owned broadband. I also think there's a lot more we can do to create what we call middle mile networks. That is to say, not quite the totally comprehensive, you know, imagine your sort of your neighborhood streets versus your roads that have double yellow lines on them. I think there's a lot of reason to believe we ought to build more of the network versions of the two-way higher speed limit streets, allow open access to those, and then let the private sector, now that we've lowered the barriers to entry, let the private sector come in and compete against each other. That should improve pricing for network access, as well as drive innovation in the ways in which they serve folks.
Great, thank you. You really know your stuff.
I try.
Very impressed. Next question, does fixed wireless fit in your model? It seems like you've partially at least answered that, or maybe you don't have anything to add to that.
Fixed wireless, for folks who are not familiar, is not this. It's not mobile wireless. Because your cell phone and the cell towers don't know where each other are, they have to send their signals out very broadly. When you have a line of sight connection or even a somewhat obstructed connection between a transmitter and a receiver that know each other's location, you can use a different set of the broadcast spectrum that can be much more information dense. And this allows us to transfer data at a speed that we would consider true broadband. Some of these networks are not and are unlikely to be anytime soon able to compete on speed with fiber to the home. But the dramatic advantage they enjoy is that you just build a tower and then you can get that signal to a whole heck of a lot of people without running fiber anywhere other than to that tower. We also think there's going to be significant organic improvements in those wireless networks over time. Each successive generation of transmission equipment is faster and higher capacity than the transmission equipment prior to it. And so once again, we make our one-time capital investment in building wireless networks out. As those transmitters are depreciated, they'll be replaced by the network owner and operator, and those networks will, without additional public subsidy, increase in speed on their own. Often that's an interim solution as fiber networks are built out. Sometimes that's a permanent solution. You know, I have used in my travels around the Commonwealth, both technologies, they're both really strong, and we don't need to be, sometimes fixed wireless is just the better option.
Okay. What are your, this is just from my experience in Albemarle County, I'm curious how you feel about locating towers on school, public school properties. There's, you know, advantages to that in terms of serving the school and the school population, but there's concerns about the electromagnetic fields or whatever that might affect the students or staff.
There is not any good reason to believe that any portions of the electromagnetic spectrum that are used to transmit information cause any harm to any humans under any context. The words electromagnetic radiation are somewhat intimidating and worrisome, but it's worth remembering that light is electromagnetic radiation. Radio waves are electromagnetic radiation. Your Wi-Fi signal in your house is electromagnetic radiation. Folks who are concerned about this are quick to say, well, you haven't studied the safety of these specific portions of the broadband spectrum. And that's mostly true, though people are doing studies now to defeat that talking point. But the reason we haven't done a ton of studies on this specific portion of the broadband of the broadcast spectrum or the electromagnetic spectrum is that it's already a fully understood physical phenomenon. In the same way, there are not a ton of studies about whether or not it's safe to immerse humans in 83.65 degree water, because we just know how water and burns work. We don't need to study this specific portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. This is non-ionizing radiation. It simply cannot penetrate your skin. It's almost certainly safer than, for example, being inside of a granite building, which emits far greater radiation, safer than most bananas. Potassium is actually mildly radiotherapeutic. There is the health concerns, you know, make sense at first blush, but they've been looked at and we're okay.
I wish you could have come to some of the Board of Supervisors meetings for that explanation.
Anytime.
Okay, next question from the public. I'm having a little trouble following this. Will 5G wireless ever be practical? Be a practical solution for people who are live far off major roads?
Sure. Sort of is the answer. True 5G, what we would call millimeter wave 5G, is very unlikely to be a technology that exists outside of dense urban cores and along interstates and other major thoroughfares. The reason for that is those transmitters must be on an already existing fiber network. And, you know, for example, in downtown Richmond, as they build out 5G, which still doesn't exist, they're going to need to put a transmitter basically every other block, every other intersection. That's wildly impractical when the population density drops even to suburban areas. There are other technologies, other improvements in mobile wireless that the industry is calling 5G in that it is different from the fourth generation, but it is not really the truly hyped, you know, the very high capacity 5G that folks talk about is that millimeter wave. That's really kind of overgrown Wi-Fi. You think about the router in your house. We're essentially doing a version of that throughout our urban centers and along our interstates to build out 5G. There is a possibility that the federal government will open up more of the broadcast spectrum to the mobile providers. There's just ferocious competition for that. It's a public good. There's only so much of it. And there are a lot of industries that are very interested in getting their own little carve out. I know the autonomous vehicle community is very interested. There's a lot of aviation and drone work that we're going to need to do with some of this broadcast spectrum. So there's pretty ferocious competition. I don't think folks should expect, similar to low Earth orbit satellites, I don't think folks should expect 5G to gallop over the hill and solve this problem for us. Ultimately, there will be much more robust wireless connectivity. throughout the Commonwealth, but it's probably going to look a lot more like the 4G LTE networks that we have in most places now, which are pretty darn fast. I mean, there are times when you're better off on your 4G network than you are even on a fiber connection. So, you know, usually because of interference in your house, but still, it's that's a good technology and one that'll get most places pretty soon.
And if we are going to keep this process moving, someone asks if an individual citizen of the Commonwealth is committed to universal broadband, what actions can he, she, they take to keep this process moving?
Sure. The most important thing is to make sure that your delegate and senator, I mean, at the state level, are committed to fully funding the governor's broadband program. And that's going to include the quasi budget that he's going to introduce in the upcoming special session of the Virginia General Assembly, during which they're going to approve or fiddle with his proposed uses for the Rescue Act monies. We're going to be asking for a lot of money for broadband. We need the General Assembly to agree with us. We're not asking for more than we need, I promise. But we do need the amount of money that we need. And so, you know, what I would say is work with them. The second thing is make sure that your city or county has a plan to get to universal coverage. As I said, we have a team of folks in the Department of Housing and Community Development whose job is to support local development of those plans. If your community doesn't have a plan to get that done, it's absolutely time to start. The train that is in the station, by which I mean the availability of federal funds this year, is truly a once in a lifetime opportunity to get this done. Communities that miss that train may not have another great shot at getting this. So this is an urgent issue in the next 2 to 3 years.
Thank you for showing us how important it is, the timeliness of it. Next question. What are the pros and cons of designating broadband as a utility?
So probably by utility, you mean something like the way the phone companies used to work or the electric providers work. There was a moment in time when we could probably have done that, but that moment in time was kind of the mid to late 1990s. It was during that period when the cable companies and the telephone companies figured out that they were in the same business. They were running wires or signals to people's homes and delivering digital packets of data. Since that time, hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of private investor dollars have been put into building out networks, many of which overlap in our dense areas. The key aspects of a utility are that it has a universal service mandate, yes, but also a monopoly territory. And so if we try to go in and deliver monopolies, government-enforced monopolies to internet service providers, we're going to have to buy out. It'll be a taking. We'll have to use eminent domain to buy out all of the existing overlapping network. That is certainly too expensive for the Commonwealth to take on. I think it's likely too expensive for the federal government to take on. I'll also say, while I'm a firm believer in the ability of government, especially Virginia state government, which is among the best, to get things done without undue political influence, I'm not incredibly confident we could carve up and generate a whole bunch of new gold-plated government monopolies in a way that was something we'd all be proud of as Virginians. So it's probably not something that we can realistically take on at this point.
Mm-hmm. And we have a last question. Last at this point anyway. So to the extent that the Commonwealth provides internet structure at low or no cost to internet providers, will that lower the ultimate cost to consumers? In other words, are the Commonwealth better off auctioning rights to the internet to internet access?
So there's a lot there. By and large, our program is not a windfall for the private network operators. We know exactly how many customers they're going to serve with each network expansion. We know what they're going to charge. And so we know what their revenues are going to be and what their costs are going to be. We really just grant them money down to make it kind of minimally viable for them to serve those areas in an ongoing fashion. And so we could try to effectively pre-purchase the cost of access for the citizens of Virginia, but that would just be a front end subsidy as opposed to a back end subsidy. At the end of the day, there is a cost to provision of this service, and you know the private sector is not going to do it for free, and they're not going to do it in a way in which they lose money. And so, if we tell them they have to charge less for network access, then what's going to happen is the amount of revenue they can gain from a unit of infrastructure is going to go down, and we're going to have to subsidize it to a greater extent. So we're paying for it one way or the other.
Okay, another question came in. In light of the timeline to serve Virginians with fiber, what can the Commonwealth and local governments do to help providers introduce new deployment methods like micro-trenching?
Sure. The biggest thing is, and this is part of the secret sauce of our program, is getting making applicants for Commonwealth support not be just a local government or just an internet service provider, but rather a partnership between those two. What we find is that, you know, if, for example, an internet service provider goes to the federal government and draws down a grant to build network in Albemarle County, say, well, when a private company comes up to a county official and says, hey, I'm planning on doing business in your county and I want to use this road and I want to use this other stuff, the county official puts on their county official hat and they say, all right, well, you know, here's the permit forms you need to fill out and here's what it costs to use our right of way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When, on the other hand, the ISP and the local government are in partnership together in pursuit of support for a project, and they know that we're going to take a very hard look at the cost efficiency of that project, what we find is that local governments, by and large, do everything they can to reduce the cost of deploying broadband out into the parts of their community that don't have it. And so permitting things like micro-trenching, like using locally owned conduit, like waiving restrictions on affixment costs to publicly owned utility poles or buildings, using publicly owned vertical assets, water towers, public safety towers, et cetera, usually that all falls away because it's in the interest of the local government to see their project succeed and their citizens get served. If you're hearing from your internet service provider that your county government is difficult to deal with, they might be right. Some county governments are difficult to deal with. But sometimes that's just sort of general grousing. There is a certain amount of government bureaucracy that needs to exist so that the government can keep everything on the rails and maintain accountability. And so, you know, I think by and large, local governments in Virginia do a great job, and they do a great job generally and in this space.
Thank you. Well, I think we might just take this last question, and it's a good way to summarize things and maybe give some of your important information that you gave at the very beginning to people who may have come in late. How important is universal broadband to the future economic growth of the Commonwealth? And you've clearly talked about that, but that's a good way to kind of sum up anything that you haven't already talked about.
Well, it's kind of crazy, right? Because we talk about this as this very aspirational thing that's going to be really hard to do. Simultaneous to that, it's incredibly necessary. Ubiquitous broadband coverage exists in most of our competitor nations. It exists in the high-performing metropolitan areas around the world and around the country. And so in very much the same way, rural telephone and rural electrification were absolutely necessary. Getting ubiquitous broadband coverage is absolutely necessary. And really remarkably, if you go back to the history, particularly of rural electrification, the people arguing against it use the same crappy, elitist arguments. Why does a farmer need, you know, farmers can plow the fields with animals, you know, they can see in the barn with lanterns. What do they need electricity for? It's the same. We have to get this done. We owe it to all of our fellow Virginians. And every area that we can't get online in the next couple of years, we're really consigning to economic diminution and failure.
Thanks. We do have another question that came in that just kind of exactly follows what you're just saying. So let me finish with that. What kind of opposition have you gotten to your plans?
Less than I expected, frankly. I think it's very easy to construct a narrative, and we do this often in political life, but where you cast the large internet service providers as villains. That has not been my experience. They are for-profit companies, and they're going to continue to pursue their financial interest, but they have also been incredibly important partners in getting the job done. Similarly, there have been some times in which we have wanted to override some aspects of local control of overland use so that we can deploy these networks more quickly. And our partners in local governments and local government associations haven't loved that. I understand why ideologically they needed to take those positions, and I understand they understand why I had to oppose them in it. And you know, for what it's worth, we've won. But this is actually a pretty broadly shared goal. And so there has been opposition to spending the amount of resources that it's going to take. There has been some opposition to methods of network deployment to serve low-income folks by existing providers because they don't particularly want the barriers to entry lowered. By and large, this has been, most of our opposition has come from simply the actual physical challenge of getting this done, not political opposition. By and large, we've had folks either grumble and sit to the sidelines or moderately enthusiastically to very enthusiastically join with us. And so, you know, I don't think we've got a ton of political opposition. You can't write a morality play about this. It tends to be much more complicated and issue specific.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to read your name and title for people who may have come late and want to write it down. Evan Fineman is the executive director of the Tobacco Region Revitalization Commission and the chief broadband advisor of the Office of Governor Ralph Northam. And we thank you so very much for being here. And it's been a lot of interest in it, obviously. And I'm sure some people will be in touch with you. If somebody needs to contact information, we can provide that to people. I want to remind everybody that we don't have a program. It's our traditional July time off. And so we'll be back in August, and we'll be both online and at the new center at Belvedere. So thank you so much, Evan, for everything you've been doing and for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Norman, and every other member of the group and everybody who joined us today and is watching it later. I appreciate the attention. I really hope you will contact your delegate and senator. We do still need help to make sure we get this done. But it's a pleasure to speak to you. And please, anybody reach out to me. I am inbox challenged these days, but I swear I will get back to you. So just reach out if there's anything I can ever do for you, and I will get it done.
Thank you very much, Norman, for hosting and moderating. And to our guest, Evan Fineman, that's an outstanding program. And again, let me remind you, we will be off in July, but we look forward to seeing you all in August. Have a good day.